I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Well, it's the sixth day of fighting on the ground in Iraq.
Coalition troops in the south are encountering sandstorms and outbursts of fierce resistance, while Allied bombardment in the southern reaches of Baghdad continue.
Despite that bombing, Iraqi Republican Guard troops reportedly moved south out of Baghdad overnight to confront Allied troops.
There were also reports of an uprising in the southern city of Basra and of thousands of chemical suits abandoned by Iraqi forces found in another part of Iraq.
In Baghdad, a missile strike on an Iraqi neighborhood reportedly killed at least 14.
Brigadier General Vincent Brooks spoke this morning on the military landscape.
Operations are ongoing. We have forces that are arrayed throughout all of Iraq at this point. And so if you are someone in the regime wondering where it's going to come from, the answer is it's going to come from everywhere. I'm not going to put very specific terms on exactly what thrust, exactly what unit. That's just not prudent for us to do that.
Brigadier General Vincent Brooks at U.S. Central Command in Qatar earlier today.
Well, Sean Naylor is a reporter with Army Times. By the way, he's with photographer Warren Zinn and working in Iraq, and you can see their work in USA Today today. And we welcome him now. Hello, Sean.
Hi, how are you?
Well, I'm fine. More to the point, how are you and where are you and who are you with?
I'm fine, too. I am near An-Najaf in central Iraq. And I am with 3rd Squadron, 7th Cavalry Regiment, 3rd Infantry Division.
Tell us what's happening there, because we'd heard reports that the Republican Guard had been moving from Baghdad, just north of where you are, down to where you are.
Well, I can't tell you everything that's happening, because I'm not sure anyone actually knows. But I can tell you that Republican Guard elements have been in contact, that means in combat with 3rd Infantry Division elements around this city. Just last night, for instance, one tank company commander here told me that his tank company encountered four Nissan pickup trucks with weapons mounted on them, filled with Republican Guard soldiers. And it was a very sandstormy sort of evening last night, with visibility reduced to zero. His tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles did not spot these trucks until they were 20 meters away. So they had a point-blank fight with them in which all the trucks were destroyed, all of the Iraqi soldiers killed. They knew that they were Republican Guard soldiers by the insignia on their uniforms. There's no doubt that the sand, the sandstorms, the low cloud cover, the sort of the fog, that seems to be a combination of all three here at the moment, is to the Iraqis' advantage. There's no doubt at all. What it does is it keeps almost all U.S. helicopters on the ground. It keeps a lot of the fixed-wing aircraft on the ground, and it makes it very difficult, even for some of the night vision devices and so forth, to see Iraqi troops at the ranges that U.S. soldiers normally expect to be able to acquire and engage targets.
Seems like it's been a couple of rough days.
Well, it has. The squadron has had some very bitter fighting. Last night, the squadron lost two tanks and one Bradley fighting vehicle to enemy fire, which, you know, when you lose two tanks in a minute, that's an extraordinary event for the U.S. Army. The number of Abrams tanks that have been lost to enemy fire in history can probably be counted on the fingers of one hand. I've heard one report that these were the first two tanks ever lost to direct enemy fire. The soldiers are well led and well trained, so morale is perfectly fine, and there have been no casualties, miraculously.
And what is the sense? What is the sense right now? You said you can't see 30 feet in front of you. Are you safe? Is there the sense of there could be any imminent attack?
Nobody's relaxing. A couple of days ago, it was a nice sunny day, and one or two of us had temporarily taken off our flak jackets or bulletproof vests, and at that moment, a heavy artillery round started raining in on our position. So I think after that experience, nobody's going to relax. Mm. This squadron has got troops in contact at this very moment with the enemy. Troops fighting just a few kilometers away with the enemy, and there's more enemy on the way. So no one's relaxing. Mm.
Sean, thank you.
Okay.
We're about to move down the road.
Oh, I got to break off. We're moving.
Okay.
Take care.
Sean, take care. Bye-bye. Sean Naylor, reporter for Army Times outside An-Najaf, south of Baghdad.
Well, Robin, there's been much emphasis, of course, in the past few days on the battle for Baghdad. But now, focus is shifting, as we just heard, south of there, where along the flanks of the Allied force, fierce resistance continues to erupt. Now, CNN reported not long before we went to air that Pentagon officials say they may have miscalculated Iraqi resistance from irregular troops, from paramilitaries, from that Fedayeen loyal to one of Saddam Hussein's sons, tough fighters all tens of thousands strong, to survey the military situation. We're joined now again by retired Special Forces Colonel Khalid Sepp. Welcome, Colonel.
Thank you.
Colonel, do you have a sense Allied forces may have miscalculated resistance?
It would certainly seem that that has occurred to some degree. They've publicly announced that they're slowing the emphasis on the northern drive, and they're going to deal with this pressure against their supply lines, which could be for a couple of very probable reasons. One is that there is too much combat against the supply convoys. And the other is to signal to the Shia population in the south that they're not going to allow this sort of activity to be addressed against either the Allied forces or against the local population.
Now, facing this resistance along their flanks, they're also facing what some commanders have called dirty tricks. How perilous for Allied forces are Iraqi tactics we keep hearing about, soldiers taking off their uniforms or simply melting away, using civilians as shields? Listen, Colonel, if you will, to what Brigadier General Vincent Brooks had to say just this morning.
The practices that have been conducted by these paramilitaries and by these others who are out there, sometimes in uniform, sometimes not in uniform, are more akin to the behaviors of global terrorists than they are to a nation.
Does this sort of thing, Colonel, have a potential to bog down a big military force?
The Allied troops, the American and British troops, are remarkably adaptive, especially down at the tactical level. It would be ideal if if everybody played by the rules of war, the legally stipulated rules of war. But as soon as it's recognized that that's not how their opponents are going to conduct themselves, they'll adapt and adjust and fight through.
Well, Colonel, speaking of military conduct, the 7th Cavalry Regiment fought ferociously with Iraqi forces near the central city of Najaf. Now, that's an interesting place. That's the Vatican for Shiite Muslims. Some concern that commanders may not be willing to unleash all the force they have at their command for fear of damaging something in that city. Are commanders held back from accomplishing all they can by concern, for example, outraging Shia Muslims in this case?
They certainly would be restrained. This is something that goes quite a ways back in American history. The outrage that emerged after the bombing of the Abbey at Monte Cassino in Italy in the Second World War, the battle in Hue in Vietnam, which was a holy city, and the larger strategic context is being kept in mind in regards to these tactical issues about where to fight and not.
But is that dangerous for a military force? Must they not unleash everything they have, fight with everything they have?
If the question moves to the point at which the trade-off is between where the trade-off would involve the loss of American life, and in that case, architecture, no matter what the religious import is going to lose.
So, Iraq then, Saddam Hussein, facing an army of 300,000, how is he doing? If you were him sitting wherever he's sitting, how would you be fighting back? Is he doing pretty well?
In a relative sense, no, he's not. The Western armies that have moved into Iraq have proceeded at a pace that would leave General Patton breathless. The American tanks are on are approaching the outskirts of his capital city. At the same time, he has a plan. He's aware that he has he's learned his lessons from the 1991 war. He sees the defense of Baghdad is central to his survival and the survival of his regime. The counterattacks that have occurred are actually very appropriate at the time. If there is a moment when the Allied forces are vulnerable, it's right now. Before all their forces are in theater, they're extended, their supply lines are open. This would be the time to counterattack. But they're being driven back.
Mm-hmm. an unfolding military situation. Thank you again for joining us to discuss it, Colonel.
Thank you.
Retired Special Forces Colonel Khalid Sepp.
We now turn to northern Iraq, where Christian Science Monitor reporter Cameron Barr is in Sulaymaniyah. Cameron, hello.
Hi, good to be with you.
What do I hear behind you, by the way?
Oddly enough, it's the rather loud heating in this hotel room, which is important because it's very cold here.
Ah, I see. Well, what is going on there besides the weather, which is not insignificant?
We have two things happening here. One is the Americans are engaged in a fight against a couple of small Islamist groups who occupy enclaves in the very eastern corner of northern Iraq. Since the weekend, the Americans have been bombing and using cruise missiles against these two groups. One group is rather well-known, Ansar el-Islam, which the Secretary of State and others have said has links to al-Qaeda. What was a little bit surprising to people here is that the cruise missile attacks also targeted a more moderate Islamist group, and this group has actually taken far more casualties from the American air attacks than Ansar has.
So, in fact, do I hear you say that inadvertently the U.S. and other forces might have brought in another and far more moderate Islamic group into a fight that they may not have been in before?
Yes, but I wouldn't say far more moderate. I'd say slightly more moderate. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's necessarily inadvertent. It's clear from the geography that the people who were doing the targeting probably knew what they were doing and that it was intentional.
So that the Kurds may be using the war with Iraq and U.S. forces in the area to take care of their own, some of their own problems, which include these Islamic groups.
There's no doubt about that. And they're also, I think, defining their Islamist opposition fairly broadly.
Yeah. Well, what about the North as the front in the war against Iraq? What's shaping up there?
I would say that it's percolating. There's increasing Kurdish frustration that they do not have sort of a Northern Alliance role with the Americans.
What impact might the looming Battle of Baghdad have on the North?
Well, I think the argument, I think the strategy is almost entirely focused on the capital. The idea being that if the Americans and the British can surround Baghdad and force the Iraqi regime and the army to surrender at once, then there won't be a need to go through the country city by city, defeating the Iraqis step by step. If that strategy proves to be successful, then presumably after the fall of Baghdad, we'll see the crumbling of Iraqi control in the north.
Well, Cameron Barr, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Christian Science Monitor reporter Cameron Barr in Sulaymaniyah in northern Iraq. For more of his reporting, go to our website, here-now.org.
Just ahead, was there an uprising by Iraqi Shia Muslims against Saddam's soldiers in the southern city of Basra? We'll have a report from Command Central.
Also, a Shia Muslim explains his culture.
And later, what exactly is contained in President Bush's $75 billion war budget request?
There's more coming up. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Well, for the past day or so, perhaps no place in Iraq's presented a more confusing picture than Basra, the country's second largest city. Basra's population of 1.3 million is ringed by primarily British troops, but the city has not fallen. British commanders have spoken of a popular uprising there against Saddam Hussein's remaining forces, a development coalition forces would certainly welcome. Today, British Prime Minister Tony Blair had this to say.
Truthfully, the reports are confused, but we believe there was some limited form of uprising. And what is absolutely clear is that once people know that Saddam's grip on power is being weakened, then there is no doubt at all they wish to opt for freedom rather than repression.
Prime Minister Tony Blair, but has the population rebelled or not? To try to answer that question, we have on the line now Group Captain Al Lockwood. He is the spokesman for British forces in the Iraq theater, and he joins us from Doha, Qatar. Hello, Group Captain.
Hello.
Group Captain, was there an uprising in Basra?
Yes, we have an accurate report that there was a civil uprising in Basra last night, where a large number of people rose up against the ruling Ba'ath Party and the militia of criminals and thugs that have been terrorizing the city for some time.
It's a city of 1.3 million. How many in the uprising, do you know?
Well, our numbers are inaccurate, but we obviously have been outside of Basra, keeping the town under surveillance and obviously making plans how we're going to relieve and liberate the city. And our reconnaissance intelligence told us there was this a confrontation between the citizens and the ruling Ba'ath Party.
Yes, Group Captain. Interestingly, I'm just handed a piece of wire copy here saying that indeed fierce hand-to-hand combat with bayonets broke out between Iraqis and Saddam Fedayeen irregulars in the southern city of Basra. Group Captain, why don't the British troops just take Basra?
We will, but we will in our own good time. What's required here is some very careful planning. We have a city, as you said, of 1.3 million people. We realize that there's a humanitarian crisis growing there, and we need to go in and do something about it. At the same time, with such a large number of civilian population, we're obviously very, very wary of incurring any civilian casualties. And indeed, we want to look after the infrastructure. And finally, it's important that when we devise any plan and before we act, we ensure that the safety of our own troops is taken care of as well. So it's important that we get conditions right. It's important that we know exactly where these irregular forces are and where they're holding out, so that we're able to locate them and if necessary, stop them quickly, and reducing, obviously, the risk to all the inhabitants of Basra.
Group Captain, we want to thank you very much for joining us.
A pleasure. Goodbye.
British military spokesman Captain Al Lockwood joined us from Doha, Qatar.
Well, the Shia Muslims in Basra and other southern cities hold the majority in Iraq. In the first Gulf War, Washington encouraged them to rise up against Saddam Hussein with disastrous consequences. Joining us on the line from London is Sayed Nadeem Kazmi. He is editor of Dialogue magazine in London and is himself a Shia. And Sayed Nadeem, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
First of all, remind us of the history of the Shia Muslims and Saddam Hussein.
Well, there's two histories, really. The Shia Muslims of Iraq really inhabit south-central Iraq and southern Iraq, which includes the old area known as the cradle of civilization, where the marsh Arabs dwell.
Mm-hmm.
So the Shia are really integral and indigenous to what we call the Iraqi heartland. In terms of Saddam Hussein, who's been there for almost three decades, ever since the Ba'ath Party came to power, it is common knowledge, an open secret as it were, that whilst trying to adopt and co-opt tribal Shiite elements and also adopt Shia symbols in order to justify his own repressive regime, he has systematically been persecuting the Shia throughout the country, not just in southern Iraq, but also in the Shia suburbs in Baghdad, Qazamain, for example.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, following the Gulf War, Hussein had another fierce interaction with the Shia population.
Yes, in 1991-92, of course, there was great hope amongst the Shia majority in Iraq that the coalition forces that were reined against Saddam Hussein at that time were going to liberate them. And unfortunately, that wasn't to take place. And the Shia majority felt quite betrayed by the promises of George Bush Sr. that didn't actually materialize. I mean, there were incidents that were reported to us of American American planes and helicopters simply standing by while massacres were taking place and simply unable or unwilling to do anything. They really are stuck between a rock and a hard place. On one side, they don't know whether, if they do come out, they're going to face their liberators. On the other, there's this haunting suspect of what's gone on in the past, and are they going to be greeted by their persecutors? So they really are in an extremely tense and uncertain physical situation, which I think doesn't really augur well for the immediate future for them.
Yeah. Well, although a secular leader, he's from the Ba'ath Party, Saddam Hussein is a Sunni Muslim. The differences between Shia and Sunni Islam, as we understand them, is over the question of succession to the Prophet Muhammad. But do you think that even if Saddam Hussein, who has oppressed the Shia population, is gone, the Shias and the Sunnis can live together?
I think that Iraq's wonderful heritage is really an example to all of us, notwithstanding the aberration that is Saddam Hussein. I think that what we have here is one of the most cosmopolitan of countries in the Arab world. It is a country that has not only Sunnis and Shias, but there are many Christians, Assyrians, Chaldeans, for example, that we can be nothing but hopeful for the future. The turmoil has been due to external factors. Internally, everything that Iraq is in terms of its cosmopolitanism, in terms of its civilizational legacy, everything that it stands for, augurs extremely well for the future.
Sayed Nadeem, thank you so much.
Not at all. My pleasure.
Sayed Nadeem Kazmi, a Shia and editor of Dialogue magazine in London.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, Iraq's neighbor to the east, Iran, and what the U.S. is doing to secure its cooperation as the war with Iraq continues. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, President Bush's big new war budget. What's really in it?
And an Iraqi-American says rebuilding Iraq requires strong backing from its youth.
The vast majority of people in the Arab world today are under the age of 30. So engaging young people is engaging the majority.
These stories and a big blow for the Bush tax cut coming up Here and Now.
I'm Ted O'Brien. President Bush visited Central Command in Florida today, where he told the troops the coalition will win the war no matter how long it takes. Speaking before a cheering crowd at MacDill Air Force Base, Bush said coalition forces will face the most desperate elements of a doomed regime as they close in on Baghdad.
Our military is making good progress in Iraq, yet this war is far from over. As they approach Baghdad, our fighting units are facing the most desperate elements of a doomed regime. We cannot know the duration of this war, but we are prepared for the battle ahead.
And Bush said the sacrifice of fallen soldiers would not be in vain as long as weapons of mass destruction held by Iraq never fall into the hands of terrorists. Two cruise missiles struck a residential area in Baghdad, killing 14 civilians, according to Iraqi officials. U.S. Central Command in Qatar says it cannot confirm the report, nor can it confirm an Iraqi claim that its forces attacked coalition troops in the south-central part of the country, inflicting casualties and destroying six armored vehicles. The U.S. says 3,000 chemical suits have been found in a hospital the Iraqis were using as a military base, raising concern that Iraq may unleash chemical or biological weapons. The humanitarian situation in Iraq is drawing increasing concern from the United Nations. Secretary General Kofi Annan says the protection of civilians should be the highest priority.
Just heard the reports that a missile struck a market in Baghdad, and I would want to remind all belligerents that they should respect international humanitarian law and take all necessary steps to protect civilians. Besides, they are responsible for the welfare of the civilian population in the area.
Meantime, the Security Council continues its negotiations over the UN's Oil for Food program. Annan wants to revive the aid plan, but some council members say the U.S. should pay the immediate humanitarian costs of the war. Federal energy regulators say California will receive nearly $2 billion in refunds after an investigation uncovered widespread manipulation of the state's natural gas and electricity prices and supplies. The FERC says seven subsidiaries of bankrupt Enron took advantage of a dysfunctional market. Checking the numbers, the Dow is down 36 points to 8,243. The Nasdaq is up 3 points. This is Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The Bush administration's request for $75 billion to fund the next 6 months of war is being met with skepticism by budget analysts who say that figure may just be the tip of the iceberg. Joining us to discuss the budget is Chris Hullman of the Center for Defense Information in Washington, D.C. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Well, first of all, tell me, what's your sense of the projected budget?
Well, of the money that was requested yesterday by the administration, only about $63 billion will actually be for the direct costs of military operations in Iraq. That's at the low end of the spectrum when you look at the various estimates that have been done both by the administration and places like the Congressional Budget Office and independent analysts as well. So my feeling is that this is almost certainly just a down payment in what will be a multi-payment plan.
What do you and other analysts mean by that? Because others are saying that as well, that this is just a down payment on a much longer bill. And how long? How big?
Well, I think it's hard to say. I mean, there are a lot of variables, the first of which, of course, is how long the actual military campaign in Iraq will be and how destructive it is. And then you have to add in other factors which are not included in that number, which will almost certainly have an economic impact on the U.S., which is the cost of humanitarian assistance, the cost of rebuilding Iraq after the war is over, We're also looking potentially at an extremely long-term commitment of U.S. military forces in the region as a stabilization force. So when you add those three other variables in there, you're talking about a bill that could potentially run into the hundreds of billions of dollars.
Right. Well, let's go to the number as it stands. $63 billion to fight the war is what the president's proposing. How much intensive fighting would that cover?
Intensive fighting isn't really what drives the cost of war. What makes up the majority of the money that the administration is requesting are the personnel costs, which are very high, and the transportation costs. A short intensive fight probably doesn't add too much to that. A long fight, whether it's intensive or not, provided that the same number of people are in country, in the region, and have to be supplied and have to be paid, that's what's really going to drive the cost of this upwards.
And a reminder that these are funds that the U.S. are absorbing alone. I mean, in the 1991 Gulf War, some estimates are that that war cost about $80 billion in today's dollars. But those costs were absorbed by other countries.
Other countries contributed over 80% to the cost of the 1991 Gulf War to the United States.
One last question to you, Chris. In the breakdown of monies, $63 billion is being asked for to fight the war, $8 billion in foreign aid, and $4 billion for homeland security. Do you think those last two numbers are realistic, are enough?
Well, I think that the international aid portion is just part and parcel of a broader initiative to funnel money into countries, either to help with humanitarian assistance or to encourage them to be supportive of our effort, i.e. the idea that we would send large amounts of financial assistance to Turkey. That's not included in here, but it may very well be back on the table at some point in time. It's almost certain that that money is underfunded. The Homeland Security money is actually, I believe, a political tool. There's been a lot of resistance in Congress to the administration's spending plans with regard to Homeland Security because they feel that they have shortchanged some of the critical accounts there. And I think that this is an effort to persuade Congress that the administration is willing to work on them in that issue. But I don't think that that figure is going to be sufficient to assuage congressional concerns. We will almost certainly be back to see more funding funneled into these initiatives in the future.
Chris, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Chris Hellman is senior analyst with the Center for Defense Information in Washington, D.C.
The Senate yesterday voted to slash the president's proposed tax cut by half. Some are calling it a symbolic defeat for a wartime president. The reduction from $726 billion down to $350 billion was passed by a margin of three votes from moderate Republican senators. But today the Senate is voting on a series of amendments, and yesterday's vote might yet be reversed. So what's the likely future of the tax cut? Mark Preston is with Roll Call Magazine on Capitol Hill. Hello, Mark.
Hey, how are you doing, Bill?
Good, Mark. Thanks for coming. Let's talk about yesterday's vote. Was this a blow to President Bush?
Yeah, it was actually a major defeat for Bush right now. I think that you accurately described it. Presidents during any kind of wartime tend to have high approval ratings, and they tend to get what they want from Congress. In fact, Bush had got what he wanted from Congress last week. A similar proposal to scale back the tax cut had failed along a 62-38 vote. However, Democrats were successful with the help of some moderate Republicans to bring it up yesterday and give this crushing blow to Bush on this main domestic issue.
Mark, why did it happen? Were senators concerned about the cost of the war, basically? Is that why it happened?
Well, really, the chatter in the hallways yesterday, Bill, was basically this was their last-ditch effort on the Democrats' part and on the part of some moderate Republicans to make sure that 726 wasn't the final number. Some Democrats, including Ernest Hollings, and some Republicans, including Lincoln Chafee, who were totally against the tax cut at all, decided that half a glass was better than a full glass of milk, basically.
Right. Mark, in the minute or so we have left, of course, this will eventually go to conference committee, a conference committee dominated by Bush loyalists. Now, the House of Representatives has already approved the full $726 billion tax cut. What does all that mean, that soup, for what eventually will happen to the tax cut?
Well, basically, you know, the Senate will end up going to the table with the House of Representatives. And what we will probably see, and this is just a wild guess and a wild number to throw out there, while we won't see the $726 billion, and while we likely will not see the $350 billion or somewhere in that range, we're going to see somewhere struck in the middle. There's going to be some compromise that is going to be struck at this table behind closed doors. Probably, I'm guessing, anywhere in the range from maybe $475 billion to maybe $500 billion. That way, both sides can declare somewhat of a victory, but yet they can't say that they totally lost.
Very briefly, tell me about those amendments we mentioned in the opening.
Well, you know, likely what you will see today, this is the end of a four-day votorama. More than 50 votes have been cast on the budget. The tax cut was tucked into the debate over the budget right now, which is going to be about $2.2 trillion for next year. What you probably will see today is Republicans will try to restore what happened yesterday, try to reverse what happened yesterday, but basically the die is already cast, and it's not going to work.
Mark Preston, thanks very much for speaking with us.
All right, take care, Bill.
Mark Preston from Roll Call Magazine spoke to us from Capitol Hill.
Still to come, a second-generation Iraqi-American tells us how a soap opera figures into the rebuilding of post-Saddam Iraq.
You're listening to Here and Now.
News from Iraq dominates the headlines, but several significant stories are coming out of parts of Asia. Today, India and Pakistan once again engaged in back-and-forth testing of missiles capable of carrying nuclear weapons. And North Korea, worried that it will be targeted by the U.S. next after Iraq, cut off its regular military contact with U.N. peace monitors. Joining us on the line is Ashton Carter. He's a professor at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard and former Assistant Secretary for Defense under President Clinton. And Dr. Carter, it seems pretty tense on the Korean Peninsula.
Well, it's ironic that as the world is understandably and justifiably focused on what's going on in Iraq, half a world away, a weapons of mass destruction drama is unfolding that is in many ways more significant than anything Saddam Hussein is doing. North Korea has, at a place called Yongbyon, fuel rods that contain five or six nuclear weapons worth of plutonium. Nobody suspects that Saddam Hussein has anything like a nuclear program approaching North Korea's. And in the last couple of months, North Korea has indicated that it's going to take those fuel rods and extract the plutonium from them, something that it has not done for 8 years since the United States reached an agreement with it called the Agreed Framework in 1994. So if that happens, that'll be the biggest episode in nuclear proliferation probably two decades or so, and it could happen right as this other war in Iraq goes on.
Well, and North Korea's state media outlet said this week that they believe that Washington is using the war against Iraq as a test for military action against North Korea. If Pyongyang and the leadership in North Korea really believes that, what does that mean?
Well, the North Korea does believe that. Actually, they've certainly said for a long time they think we're out to get them. Now, President Bush has indicated that he is going to seek a diplomatic solution with North Korea. And that sounds good, except he hasn't done anything to follow through on that pledge. In other words, there have been no talks between North Korea and the United States. So we will find ourselves, if we don't do something within the next couple of months, we'll find ourselves with a fait accompli, a situation in which North Korea now has the bomb and not just fuel rods. So our options are narrowing.
Well, Dr. Carter, while we have you here, there's, of course, news in other parts of the world. On Monday, 24 Hindus living in India-controlled Kashmir were massacred, apparently by Muslim extremists. What is the concern about another flare-up of violence between the Hindus, who lead India's government, and the Muslims in Pakistan, and both countries with nuclear capabilities?
Well, in other circumstances, this might be one of those situations where you would worry, as we do periodically, that India and Pakistan are going to go to war, and because they're both nuclear powers, such a war could be a nuclear war. But it just so happens that both the government of Pakistan and the government of India are preoccupied now with other things, domestic politics. Pakistan certainly with the war in Iraq and the war on terrorism. So even though this is the season for warfare in South Asia, most people are betting that this incident will blow over and will not be that powder train that could lead to nuclear war that we always fear whenever anything happens between India and Pakistan.
Ashton Carter, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Ashton Carter, professor at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard and former Assistant Secretary for Defense under President Clinton.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Even as the Iraq War unfolds, analysts are planning a post-war Iraq. One offering comes from 28-year-old Joseph Browdy, a scholar of Near East languages and Islamic history and a business consultant to Mideast governments and companies. Joseph is also a second-generation Iraqi-American whose mother was born into a middle-class Jewish family in Baghdad. His new book is called The New Iraq, Rebuilding the Country for Its People, the Middle East, and the World. And then we thought we'd talk to him about one aspect of his book, Rebuilding Iraq's Human Infrastructure. So, Joseph, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
Do you think that your age might make you better able to see a future Iraq?
Well, one thing about being 28 and working and living in the Middle East is that you're in touch with the population that is the very largest in the region. The vast majority of people in the Arab world today are under the age of 30. Mm. So engaging young people is engaging the majority in any Arab country.
Well, for example, in the U.S., people watch The Sopranos on HBO. Iraq had its own show called
The Wolves of the Night, which is in Arabic, the Ab al-Layl. It's also a gangster TV show that was broadcast to enthralled audiences in the 1990s.
Well, what does that show tell us about Iraqis?
Well, the fact that Iraqis identified with the Wolves of the Night says something about the society that emerged in the era of sanctions. The Iraqi people suffered under the double whammy of international sanctions and the brutal surveillance of the police state that had been there even before. And there was a type of a muted anarchy that emerged. People became very resourceful, very entrepreneurial, and organized crime, or a sort of an underworld, evolved in which many people took part.
Well, that's even more interesting because we thought Iraqis only saw Saddam on TV. You write about a joke that's going around that a Kurd walks into a repair shop with his broken television. The repairman takes a picture of Saddam off the wall, glues it to the screen, and says, "There, now it works."
Yes, unfortunately, like Al Capone said when someone suggested that he ought to be done with the pleasantries and become mayor of Chicago, we laugh because it's funny and we laugh because it's true. If you turn on the TV in Iraq, most of the time you're going to see photographs of Saddam seated on a throne with the words "voice of the truth" underneath, and he talks and expostulates on whatever he's in the mood to discuss. The next step for Iraq is the introduction of a pluralism of voices, a competition in the marketplace of ideas. And I suspect that it's going to be a sort of a media free-for-all. You're going to see elements from the neighborhood, including Iran and Saudi Arabia, seeking to fund their own media ventures. You're going to see the United States and Europe entering the fray, and indeed Iraqi exiles, journalists who have been writing out of London and elsewhere, will return to the country and seek to start their own newspapers and other operations.
You also write about the important role of publishing in a new Iraq.
Iraqis, there's an expression in Arabic that books are written in Cairo, printed in Beirut, and read in Baghdad. And it's true. Iraqis have been traditionally highly literate. According to Iraqi government estimates, literacy rates were once as high as 87%. And the fall of the Iraqi economy has been disastrous for publishers throughout the Arab world who lost a major consumer market. So with the revitalization of that economy and higher literacy rates returning to Iraq, there is hope for a burst of intellectual activity in publishing.
What do you see as the biggest problems if, in fact, Baghdad falls, Saddam Hussein leaves, and there is the rebuilding of Iraq?
Well, I'd say that the number one problem is societal healing. There will be so much resentment in so many different directions toward stalwarts of the Ba'ath Party who are responsible for killing of many people in every Iraqi city and in some cases a campaign of genocide in the north. There will be sectarian issues of which religious or ethnic group is poised to lead the country. My view is that as outsiders we should see the challenge not through the prism of colonial identity politics, Shia, Sunnis, and so on, but through economics and the need to foster social and economic justice by cutting down oligarchs and fostering new elites.
Where are these new elites? Where will they come from?
They're hard to find, but they do exist. One of the new expressions in contemporary Iraqi slang is the cats of the embargo. Mm. These are people who actually hail from a variety of ethnic backgrounds and span the country, who enrich themselves in the era of sanctions, paying protection money to the Ba'ath Party, nominal allegiance, but essentially they became part of an underworld that profited by exporting to Iraq, stockpiling goods, waiting till their value rose, and sending them into the country. So these are a dangerous and certainly a tough lot. They cut their teeth competing in a brutal underworld, but they are multi-ethnic, and they may be among our partners in this emerging state.
I'm surprised they called them the cats, given the popularity of that television show, that they didn't call them the wolves.
That's right. The TV show Zi'ab al-Layl means the wolves of the night. And the cats of the embargo. It's interesting. You've got the canine and the feline. It sounds almost Soviet. Yeah. The wolf and the sheep.
But do you think that's why one of the reasons why that show was so popular? Because in a way, people understood that that's how, you know, that sort of living on the criminal edge was how many Iraqis were surviving.
That's just it. They identified with the wolves of the night because everyone was doing what they needed to do to get by.
Where does the middle class come from? I mean, we've talked about Saddam Hussein's elite, and we know there are many impoverished and hungry people, but where does the middle class, the engine that can drive a country, where do they come from?
The middle class has been gutted over the past 13 years. So we don't have a middle class of any significance to work with at the moment. We have wealthy elites, and we have a vast majority of an undereducated underclass. And that's part of the challenge. We talk about representative government in Iraq, but I make the point that it doesn't matter how many Shia or Kurds are part of a cabinet ruling the country. If the vast majority of Shiis, for example, are an impoverished, undereducated underclass. So fostering new elites and fostering a middle class is something that will come with the lifting of sanctions, the flowing of oil into and oil revenue back into the country, and hopefully a debt regime that enables Iraqis to have much debt forgiven and the rest rescheduled so that their future is not mortgaged to other countries.
Joseph, thank you.
Thank you.
Joseph Browdy, author of the new book, The New Iraq, Rebuilding the Country for Its People, the Middle East, and the World.
And before we go, this news summary of the day's developments.
The BBC is reporting that a large number of Iraqi tanks and armored personnel are heading southeast out of Basra and towards the Al-Faw Peninsula.
The report says British military sources are noting that the movement could be an Iraqi counterattack to recover ground lost over the last few days, or possibly a tactical retreat due to reports of uprisings by Iraqi citizens in Basra.
President Bush visited U.S. Central Command headquarters in Florida this morning to address military personnel taking part in the war.
As they approach Baghdad, our fighting units are facing the most desperate elements of a doomed regime.
President Bush rallying the troops in Florida.
U.S. military commanders say allied troops are preparing to deal with possible chemical weapons attacks after 3,000 chemical suits were discovered in an Iraqi hospital.
A Pentagon spokesperson says there's evidence that a big convoy carrying Iraq's Republican Guard was headed south out of Baghdad. But Brigadier General Vincent Brooks said this morning he had no information on the reported advances.
We've not seen any significant movements from in and around Baghdad. There have been some local positionings, there have been some survival positionings, but not serious attacks, and we certainly remain, we believe, well in control of the situation at hand.
U.S. Central Command also says there are reports that bridges have been rigged with bombs in several parts of Baghdad.
U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan says he is increasingly concerned about the humanitarian situation in Iraq. He cited a cruise missile that struck a Baghdad market, reportedly killing at least 14 civilians.
Saudi Arabia backed away from its announcement yesterday that it made a peace proposal to the U.S. and Iraq, saying that it only offered general ideas about ending the war.
And Iraq's state-run television is back on the air, despite Allied air assaults that knocked out the signal overnight.
And MTV Europe is pulling any war-related rock videos, even those by the 80s group The B-52s.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Stay tuned to your public radio station for the latest developments on the war.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.